All right, so welcome to Multimedia Security. Last week we started to talk about steganography. And I'm just going to continue on this today. So the goal of steganography is to have a covert channel through which two parties, A and B, can communicate without being noticed. Yeah. So the difference to cryptography is that in cryptography, everyone knows that there's a communication going on. It's just unreadable. And steganography, the communication itself can be encrypted as well, but the actually important part is to hide the fact that there is a communication going on in the first place. And this makes sense in scenarios where there is an opponent that is like very powerful. So the opponent has a lot of control over the whole communication network, such that, because otherwise, if the opponent has less control, then hiding the fact that communication is going on is rather easy. So the way to think about steganography is in terms of this prisoner's model. So Alice and Bob sit in two cells in prison, and they may exchange stuff, magazines, whatever. But there's a powerful warden that has nothing to do all day, and he looks at everything that is exchanged. And if they exchange secret messages, they get in trouble. So yeah, so that is the picture. Now thinking about the possibilities, like what could be used as a covert channel. If you think of internet communication, a lot of things come to mind, no? Like, for example, if we think of the network stack, no, the TCP/IP network stack, then I think it's relatively straightforward to open a covert channel there. For example, by manipulating this, there's a counter that shows the packet lifetime. Is it TLE? Total life? No. Ah, oh. So in the TCP/IP stack, and if you look at the header, there's like the sender IP address, the receiver IP address, and so on and so on. And there's also a counter that indicates, okay, after, like, if this counter is set to zero, the package should be discarded. It's part of the routing protocol, because it could be that a package runs in circles. Do you know what I'm talking about? Did you? TTL, yes, it's time to live, right? Oh, thank you. Okay, TTL, right. So you initialize it with something, let's say 200, yeah? And then every hop on the network reduces it by one, yeah? And it's part of the protocol that if you actually end up with a zero, then you should drop the package because apparently something went wrong. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, typically how many hops does a package do? Let's say 10. No. So we could say if we like to transmit a zero, we initialize our time to live with 100. If we like to transmit a one, we initialize it with 200, yeah? And then the receiver can see, okay, is the TTL number that I received, is it closer to 100 or is it closer to 200? And then that is one bit of information. Yeah, things like that. So, I mean, that's a very, I think, a very straightforward way to open a covered channel. And there are plenty of such channels in or possibilities for such channels in the communication protocols. Yeah. Another. So let's write down a note on this. So network communication protocols. Offer a number of opportunities for covered channels. Consider, e.g., for example, the TTL entry in TCP/IP and the TCP/IP header. It has a maximum size or maximum value range of 0 to 255. But we typically need much less entries or hops. In the network. So an example Stego system could be encode 0 as time to live of 100 and a 1 as, I mean, that's a super stupid system, but anyways, no? As TTL of 200, yeah? Something like that. And it should be okay. The sender should be able to figure it out whether it was a 0 or a 1. Mm-hmm. So ideas of this type, there are plenty of opportunities. Yeah. Also very popular are so-called timing channels. No? For example, when you are downloading a large file, it's subdivided in a lot of packages, and you could vary the timing with which the server provides these packages a little bit, depending on whether you like to transmit a 0 or a 1. Yeah. and then the sender, of course, I mean, you have to do it in a way that is such that the sender has across these various hops still the opportunity to recognize which package was delayed a little bit more, which package was delayed a little bit less. But in principle, that's also a very, I think, obvious way of doing things when you think of network communication. No? So another popular family of channels. Is based on package timing. So delay packages a little bit to encode 0 and 1. Yeah. And then, of course, so these are things where we sort of hook onto some existing communication. So we're not looking at the contents of these network packages at all, but we are more or less at protocol level, we are encoding that information. Yeah. And then, but now if we think of putting information in images or so, then we're not so much interested in the protocol, but more interested in embedding the information in the actual like content that is exchanged. So that is like another family of methods. So another possibility analogously to watermarking is to embed or to use, sorry, to use the transmitted content as cover for the Stego message. For example, or G, the image or an audio file or a video. An audio file or even a text. Yeah, actually, I did not mention that. I think it's not so important for our actual work, but if we think of this class of steganographic techniques that essentially use the communication carrier to encode the steganographic content, if we think of written text, this would correspond maybe to inserting spaces or so in the text to encode a message, yeah? Like have double spaces between words versus single spaces, something like that, yeah? So that would be at protocol level. To embed a message in a text, so to use the text itself as cover, what would such an embedding look like?
Rearranging words.
Yeah, you could do that. Yeah, okay. That would work, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the classic example where you have in a newspaper the very first word of every line.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can say you have a certain position, like the beginning of a paragraph, the letter always counts, or the beginning of a line, you take that letters, those letters, so that would work, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Or you could substitute words, as you say, in a predefined manner. No, it could also be like dictionary based. No, that you say, okay, you have a dictionary that lists words of the same meaning, or families of words of the same meaning, and then based on that, like which word has been used, like you encode your zeros or ones or so, something like that. That would be with text, no, and it would be very classic because people are exchanging text for a much longer time than images. Okay. Good. Yeah, so in principle, these are the possibilities. The criteria that define a good system, yeah? So the quality criteria. For steganographic systems, okay, like the number one undisputable thing is undetectability, because otherwise, like, the whole story breaks. Yeah, undetectability. So this is, I don't know whether you enjoyed Latin, but it's a conditio sine qua non, as the Romans would probably say. So it's something that we cannot go without that, because that's the whole purpose of this exercise. Yeah, but it turns out that this is not an absolute requirement. But if we start to engineer a method, then it turns out the degree of undetectability is actually a function that depends on other desires that we might have with our steganographic system. Yeah, and these desires, they are actually similar to what we know already from watermarking. Yeah, so one thing is the payload, like how long can the message be that we would like to embed. Yeah, and it's probably, so it's maybe a little bit more important in steganographic systems than in watermarking, because in watermarking, we can oftentimes find an excuse like, okay, we just embed a customer ID and then the remainder is found in a database or something. Yeah. But here, I mean, the whole reason why we would like to have an undetectable communication is to exchange some message that the other side doesn't have. So we have to be able to potentially transmit a lot of bytes, not just to have a meaningful message here for the other party. So payload is probably the number two thing. And then we come to things like robustness. That means, so what if, for example, this time to live tag, it's a little bit, I mean, it's in a way also fragile, because we could have a router that says, okay, I'm not forwarding any time to live tags that are larger than 15 because I don't need it in practice or so. And then that router sort of kills our communication, no? And it's a very easy process for that example to just kill it. Yeah, or we could have another router that just caches packages, and that router sort of kills our timing channels that we use to encode our zeros and ones or so. So in that sense, these would be not very robust ways to embed things. No? Or as we talked about for images already, what if we apply a lossy compression to the images? Then it's not robust. Okay. Yeah, and it will turn out that particularly also payload and undetectability, they have a special relationship, no? Because it's much easier to transmit only very few bits, no? And hide them somewhere in a huge stream of stuff, no? As opposed to being forced to really transmit a lot of data and therefore creating a significant statistic that potentially deviates from a covered channel. Yeah? Okay. And is that my phone? Yes, sorry. Sorry for that. Okay. All right. So so that undetectability is essentially a security feature. And I think that is a good opportunity to formalize this a little bit to have some mathematical framework or so in which to look at security. Steganographic security. So a key term here, which I'm not going to write down now, but it's maybe good to have heard about it, is to hide in plain sight. Yeah, so that is oftentimes used. So you're saying, okay, I'm exchanging here these messages. Look at these messages in their statistical distribution, and if you find it okay, could you please forward it to Bob? So it's like you show everything to the warden and ask him to forward it, and in that process, so let's define what we mean by perfect security. Okay, so what we need. A cover. So let the cover be denoted as C. Yeah. So this is a random variable. With distribution, so probability distribution. PC. So you know that abbreviation, PDF, probability density function. Well, sorry. Okay. And then we embed a secret message. And that is like a function that we define in that cover C. So we embed that message in that cover. And then we have another distribution that is PS. So that is the probability distribution. Of all Stego objects So all covers plus messages. Produced by our steganographic system. So that means so in order to calculate that distribution PS, we are considering probability distributions K and M, and we look at the relative entropy dP1, P2. Hold on. So let me write this somewhere else down and then put it together. So the relative entropy dP1 P2 is just defined as the sum over all instances of Q P1 Q times log base 2 of P1 Q over P2 Q. Okay, so we have two probabilities, P1 and P2. So one is the, in terms of our steganographic system, so one is the distribution for the cover. The other is the distribution for the stego system. Yeah. And, both, are instances of a large set Q essentially. And having these definitions, you can say, okay, so let some script S denote a steganographic system. PS, PC, we defined that already. So S is epsilon secure if the relative entropy of the cover distribution to the stego distribution is lower or equal than epsilon. No? So what does that mean? So that means, so if we think of the entropy, so what does the entropy mean? The entropy essentially says, if we know one, like how much more information do we need or do we get from knowing the second one or looking at the second item? Yeah. So, so we look at the stego distribution. Take that as a baseline or so. Yeah. For example, how much more do we learn if we then look at the cover distribution? Yeah. Okay. And if this is like this amount that we additionally learn, like the mismatch between those two distributions, if it's smaller than epsilon, then we can say that system is epsilon secure. Yeah. Just to have some notion. Yeah. So in that sense, this term of security, or this notion of security, is seen in a probabilistic sense. Yeah. Like, how much do our cover distributions and our Stego distributions differ? If they don't differ at all, we have perfect security. Yeah. So that is a small, like a tiny conclusion. If epsilon equals zero, PC equals PS, must be like that, because then we have the logarithm of one. Logarithm of one is zero, and then D of PC PS equals zero. We achieve perfect security. So in a statistical sense, there's no way for a warden to distinguish a Stego object from a cover object. Yeah. Okay, I mean, that's a rather theoretical result, because we're probably not gonna get there with practical systems. But I mean, if you're thinking about theoretical results anyways, there are steganographic schemes that we can think of that are perfectly secure. And I think it makes sense to look at them for 5 minutes or so to better understand why practical systems are not perfectly secure. Yeah. Okay. So let's quickly design a perfectly secure scheme according to this definition. Smaller is better, yeah. Right. Actually, there's let me link this. I don't know whether you looked at the worksheet, but let me link this to the actual, like, the running exercise. So the task there is to perform a least significant bit embedding in an image. So least significant bit embedding essentially means you have a color in a channel. It's an 8-bit entry, yeah, and you just replace the last bit with a message bit, okay, and save it in a lossless format, because JPEG is really not good for this operation. Yeah, okay, and then. And then we switch sides and sort of perform a stick analysis of these least significant bit embeddings. Yeah. And in that notation, I mean, if we connect these notations, we are interested in the Stego distribution, which in our case is the result of a least significant bit embedding. And we would like to compare this to the cover distribution, which is, yeah, okay, it's the distribution of these images in the UCID database that we used already for the watermarking. Yeah. Okay. And since the embedding is just in the last in the last bit, it doesn't make sense to compare the images, like do a full-blown comparison of these images. But instead, what we do is that we say, okay, we filter the image. So let's call the image I. We filter the image by a convolution with a Laplace kernel. So let's say a high pass filter, yeah? Sloppy notation. Anyways, so in order to get the high frequency content, which particularly also should contain this least significant bit embedding. And then, so that is some image. So that's the high pass filtered version of that image, let's say. And then let's look at an histogram of these high pass coefficients. Yeah. So then we look at a histogram of these values. Now, when you think of this histogram, that's pretty much like a probability distribution in a way, no? So, and then it turns out, hopefully, we will see. then it turns out that the histogram for PC, it looks like a Laplace distribution. So that means around zero, it's very peaky, yeah? And then it drops off quickly. Why is that? Because most of the time, neighboring pixels are very similar, yeah? So if we look at the differences of the neighbors, they are also, they really concentrate around zero, yeah? And now if we then look at the Stego distribution, it turns out it also looks a little bit like this, but not quite, yeah? And that is because we are flipping the last bits here and there, yeah? So, and then, now if we see this, if we consider this as a statistical testing problem, yeah, or if we think of it in terms of this entropy, one step after another, yeah, then how much do we need to learn in order to get from here to there, for example? Yeah, quite a bit, no? Because a couple of things did change here, no? And that is what makes this relative entropy non-zero, yeah. So this mismatch between the distribution. No? Distributions. And the way then to get there is to perform a statistical test. Yeah, that would be like a very, very, I don't know, bachelor studies way of figuring out whether two distributions are identical or not. Huh? Yeah. Okay. And this statistical test also doesn't do. Essentially, it evaluates a function like this. Yeah, if you look at the function value of what is computed for the chi-square test or so, it's very similar in spirit to this relative entropy. No, okay. Good. Where were we? Yeah, so perfect security. That would be if we had epsilon equals zero. And how can we achieve a situation where cover distribution and embedding distribution are identical? So I think it's straightforward to achieve if we allow ourselves to not only match the Stego distribution to the cover, but also to adapt the cover a little bit to the Stego distribution. Yeah. So theoretical example. To achieve perfect security so we can say let our cover C just be the set of all random bit strings. Yeah. So let C be the set. Sorry. Let C be the set of all bit strings. Bit strings. Of length n, if you like, anyways, of length n, and PC, the uniform distribution on C. And now, the sender picks one instance, like one bit string at random, no? And computes the Stego image as that random cover XOR the message that should be embedded. And this is an XOR. The resulting Stego images are also uniformly distributed. And therefore we're good. Are also uniformly distributed. So we conclude the entropy of PC PS equals zero. Yeah. So we have two uniform distributions that cannot be distinguished. So we're good. So where's the problem here? The problem here is, write this down, and then let's talk about the problem. Or maybe let's at first make the construction clear if it's a little bit opaque. When we have time to talk about it, we need to rush.
Just not getting it. The the XOR, I have a randomly chosen scene and a message. And I XOR it.
So then it,
the message, the guess is what I said. And I receive, someone tells me this decoded message.
Yeah.
I receive the yes.
Yeah.
How can I get to the message?
Oh, we made an agreement before we got in prison. And that agreement says, That agreement says, I am, in order to generate C, I have a number generator that I need to seed with the date. So, and on every day, I'm only exchanging one message, for example. Yeah.
Again, if I XOR it, the signal XOR gets dominant. I mean, the C is randomly chosen. But my message is not randomly chosen. So therefore, there's still some,
yes.
If I'm the one and I look at it, I can realize that it's not C. If I only set C, it's only random noise. It's a uniform distribution.
So it's a string of length n, and I know this string is chosen from from a uniform distribution.
And if I have a clear message and then I'm the one and I intercept the message, I can read it and understand it. And it is perhaps encrypted, I can distinguish what kind of information perhaps is in there. I don't know. But I mean, the message itself is not uniformly distributed. Perhaps I have the feeling that I have mixed two signals. I can still see one of the dominant parts.
Yeah.
I can guess what the other signal should be.
Yeah, you can't. So let's say you have a very structured signal in your message, a lot of zeros, a lot of ones, and then again, a lot of zeros, a lot of ones, and so on. So nice sequences of identical symbols. And now you're XORing this with a sequence that is, I don't know, truly random TM. So that means, so in that subsequence where you embed your message, all bits here of that sequence will be flipped. But still, from the perspective of one looking at it, it still looks like a random sequence, unless you choose your cover message depending on that message. So then, of course, you could create some anomalies, but if you just randomly pick a message, then the result of that XOR is equally random. And also every day, every other day, you pick a new cover here. So also, if they are sending the same greeting every day, every time it looks different because the cover is different. And but this is probably not even convincing. So the thing is, what we need to consider, the Ward has a lot of time here. He can watch that communication for 20 years or how long they sit in prison, no? So he can collect a lot of samples, no? And the question that the Ward keeps asking himself is like I have all these messages here collected over 20 years. So is this set of messages, like all of them, are they uniformly distributed? Like, are they randomly drawn from the universe of all bit strings of length n? So the ward asks, the warden asks himself, were the messages from the past 20 years drawn from a uniform distribution? That is the question that the warden has to because he knows the cover comes from a uniform distribution. So it's okay if they are only exchanging covers, they are good. Yeah. So that is legal. No, it's legal to exchange covers, but it's not legal to exchange Stego messages. And but it's not. But to the warden, the Stego messages also are uniformly distributed. Yeah. So what is the difference? So first of all, why is this a theoretical concept? It's a theoretical concept because the warden wouldn't like the prisoners to exchange random strings. Yeah. So that is a fundamental problem here. Because, I mean, no sane person would exchange random strings. So if someone says, I'd like to exchange random strings, then you would say, oh, are these, by chance, are these encrypted messages? No? This looks like an encrypted message to me, a uniformly distributed binary string. No? And then no matter what the prisoner replies, the warden will forbid that communication. Yeah. So and that is actually an important constraint, yeah, because that means that the prisoners may only exchange messages for which the cover distribution is more unfriendly. So they have to adapt to the cover distribution and cannot really design the cover distribution, yeah. And that is a fundamental difference. Like they may, for example, exchange natural images. That is what they may do. Yeah. But then they have to live with the distribution of natural images instead of setting their own synthetic distribution. Let me clarify this. Whoops. This is a theoretical example. Let me stress this. And it works because the prisoners can freely choose their cover distribution. So if they say, oh, all that we are exchanging are uniformly distributed strings, And then if they are imprinting something on these uniformly distributed strings with an XOR, it remains uniformly distributed. So the warden has no chance. Yeah. In practice, if the warden would forbid exchange uniformly distributed strings, I think the strongest argument for that is that these could even be encrypted messages, no? So the warden has thousands of reasons to forbid this. The encrypted messages. And Alice and Bob would have to work with existing cover distributions. So that is the challenge. Yeah? Cover distributions. Like, for example, the manifold of JPEG encoded natural images or so. That would be a story, you know, that is totally plausible. Manifold of JPEG encoded natural images. And then it happens and then this effect happens like with the least significant bit encoding. Yeah. This only works because we are looking at natural images. Yeah. And we can say, okay, if this is a natural image, then two neighboring pixels don't change so often. Yeah. And that is why we have that Laplace distribution. So that comes from a natural image. And now if someone says, oh, I do a least significant bit embedding, then he deviates in a noticeable way from the distribution from the cover distribution and he's screwed, no? If someone checks, no? Okay. Okay, and then, I mean, if we think of this definition of security, then I already said it in the example from the exercises, the way to detect that is essentially to perform a statistical test. And so detection of, stego messages when the warden defines a statistical test function. F that maps the observed distribution to 0 and 1, and that function is, we take one of these messages that are exchanged and have to make a decision either for a one. So that means that C contains a secret message. And zero, if it's a, yeah, if it's just a cover. So otherwise, yeah, good. And then a really quick reminder. I mean, since this is a statistical test, we do have a hypothesis, and that means we have two types of errors. And you certainly remember they really are called like that. So type one error and type two error. So the type two error is that Wendy does not notice the embedded message. Yeah. So Wendy does not detect the embedded message. The type one error is that Wendy thinks there's an embedded message, but she's wrong. Yeah. So type one error, Wendy claims that there is a message, but she's wrong. So you could call the first thing a false positive, the second a false negative. Huh? Yeah. Okay, and then, so our goal all the time is to raise these type two errors like into an order of magnitude that one has to say, okay, actually Wendy is just guessing. No? She doesn't really notice any of these messages. And whenever she claims there's a message in, then it's just random. No? Okay. Okay, and now it can be shown that if you have an epsilon secure system, that then and Wendy is not better than that in her detection, that she always makes these type two errors, that she misses all embedded messages. Yeah.
So, but let's talk about this in a different context. If mm-hmm. we are the military and we have that option available that we can communicate in uniformly distributed mm-hmm. Noise, then we have a perfectly secure communication channel.
In terms of, yeah. Yeah, but people know that we are communicating. I mean, we're not, it's not a secret anymore that we are. Or people know that they don't know that we are, like what we are communicating about. Yeah, that's the problem, right? So, because in this JPEG exchange scenario, Wendy thinks she knows what they are communicating about. So, oh, they are exchanging vacation pictures. But in fact, they are having a different type of communication. But if someone is exchanging uniformly distributed messages, then you know that you don't know. I mean, you can say, oh, that's for sure encrypted. So I don't know what they are talking about.
You can't recover the original message.
No, you can't. No, that's true. It's,
there is
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would like to add that an attacker may just distort the signal or just add noise, sending noise itself to make it hard for the receiver to get the original image. And the second problem would be that every station which wants to communicate with this channel needs the same random number generator, right?
Yes.
So it needs to generate this cover seed. So if any of your stations get captured, the enemy has your random number generator and can just listen.
Yeah. So let's say the warden does not search the cell so much.
Yeah, but it's a military scenario. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The allies have enough in emails.
Yeah, yeah. Then it's probably broken. Yeah, yeah. Right. No, but that is actually a this is not just a theoretical problem. If you think of the fact that we are not producing any computer hardware in Germany, so that is a little bit inconvenient because we can put any software on the computers. That's cool. Yeah, but it's not like we are alone on our cell necessarily, because there could be any type of software built into the hardware that searches our stuff continuously, and we cannot do anything about it. And that's kind of a silly situation that really puts this whole security thing a little bit in jeopardy. So you have to, so at some point, when you think of your personal computer, at some point you need a trust anchor in the hardware, because otherwise you're screwed. It's just done, yeah? And for example, Intel is trying to provide this with this trusted, whatever. I'm not an expert on this, but they say, okay, there's a small module in hardware on the chip, yeah, that is certainly not without, not filled with spyware and stuff, yeah. And you can be a partner of Intel, for example, can put specific software modules in there, and then you have that trusted core that you need to link, to validate the software that is running and to make sure no one is peeking into your stuff, you know? But then again, also these trusted modules, I don't know. I mean, they are also built in some factories somewhere, you know, like you have, at some point you have to put some trust in something. And it would, of course, be easiest if you built the hardware yourself, no? And the assumption a little bit is that in this prison you have a little factory or something that makes you confident with your computations and that they don't leak. No? Yeah, and that's a real problem. I mean, that's actually, so in that sense, it might also be like if someone, I mean, yeah, let's not dwell too much in conspiracy theories, but let's say you build your hardware in a country which you don't necessarily trust, yeah? And then it could be that that country has that steganography problem, that they would really like to relieve you of some of your secrets and to secretly carry this off your computer, yeah? But of course, they also would have the problem that they would have to be very careful and not in order not to be noticed, no? Because, I mean, I don't know, it's that technology is built into like millions of computers. And if someone figures out, oh, my computer is having some unsolicited communication with his home country, then it's probably, I mean, it's a disaster, no? But that is actually, I think all in all is not such a totally absurd scenario, no? So it's, these hardware stacks are just black boxes, no? And they are very, like, from an intelligence perspective, they are extremely powerful black boxes, no? Like, with, and it's so convenient, like, everyone is putting these Amazon bugs into his living room, so you can get all the communication that is going on in all buildings and so on, like you're golden, yeah? If you only get the information somehow out without being noticed, no? So it's certainly not an application that is relevant to normal industry branches or so, but although it's an old topic, no, and it has peaked in these Cold Wars and so on scenarios, no, it's something that is still is still relevant, no? I mean, these techniques in principle, no? But you can also consider it just as a mathematical, like statistics sports, yeah? You can say, okay, so how can I define an embedding that, well, okay, probably I cannot find an embedding that exactly matches the cover distribution. But we will look at a couple of nice papers from the group of Jessica Friedrich. She's done great work in that field. And she designed, or she helped someone design a Stego system where they thought, okay, maybe can we build a system that is so complicated that the stack analysis people cannot build a detector that is specific enough to do this distinguishing game of the two distributions. So that was cool, and they called it Hugo, highly undetectable Stego or so. And then there was a challenge. The name of the challenge was Boss, so it was Hugo Boss. And then Boss was break our steganographic system. So that was another team. So Jessica was not like personally involved in that, I guess. And it's a small community. I mean, at least everyone knew everyone. But then Jessica helped to break that, to actually find a detector for Hugo. And that's really a nice story. So we will look at a couple of papers. And as always, you don't need to go through all the details, but I think it's an entertaining story. And it shows a little bit, I think it illustrates very nicely the way in which the thinking in this direction works from a mathematical perspective, yeah? Or pattern recognition also perspective. Okay, maybe we close here for today, but I'd like to show you something else. So I was Googling for this. So that was this. Actually, it's not super novel. It was, I think, 2010 or so. Yeah. So break our steganographic system, Boss. And so Jessica Friedrich, she comes from the Czech Republic originally, and there are a couple of Czech people somehow in this business. okay, and then Jessica wrote that paper on breaking Hugo, and that is actually, she wrote two papers. So one is rather technical on, okay, you know, build a system like this and this and this and this. But then there's this paper, and this is really nice because she's actually just writing up, okay, first we tried this and then we tried that and it didn't really work, and then we tried something else, and so it goes step by step, yeah, and it's really nice. It's so nice. 17 pages, but if you're interested, it's gonna be very, very enjoyable. And it talks about a lot of things that you know already. Yeah. So can we do detection like correlation, like in watermarking? So you can say like, hey, I know that already, and so on. No? And then pixel domain is not useful, right? Right, that's what we said, actually. But okay, yeah, just doing some advertising for that paper. I'll put it on Studon. And turns out she's going to talk also about so-called spam features. And I think Patrick mentioned that when he gave a presentation, because a couple of people in image forensics are using these spam features now for forensic analysis of images. But that also comes from Jessica Friedrich originally. So let's... see what else Jessica did. Yeah, so she actually she won the Czech championships on speed cubing because she actually she came up with a with an algorithm that that works really well. There was a video that was a concatenation of all her speed cubing videos. I don't find it. Anyways, let me show one of them and then. Ah, yeah, that is the one, right. Yeah, actually it's a short one because she's so fast in doing it. I don't know whether you played Rubik's Cube at some point. But essentially, there are algorithms, thanks to Jessica, for example, there are algorithms to do this effectively and quick. And her algorithm essentially consists of a couple of sub-methods, and the comments that that are written there refers to these sub-methods. Yeah, and F2L is one of the sub-algorithms. Yeah, so she's a mathematician by training, and she just likes to think about stuff. And then at some point, she thought about that cube and came up with that method, how to solve it. And another time, she thought about steganography. Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, that's a nice hobby. Okay. Yeah, okay. So it's anyways. Good. So yeah. So she's really great. And as I said, I'll put a number of papers from her work group online, and then we can have next time a little bit more technical look at how we can practically perform a highly undetectable embedding, or how to detect such a highly undetectable embedding. Okay, so that's all. For, yeah, sorry, question. Yeah.
Could I increase the type 2 error by putting not messages, but also nonsense?
No, I think it's not legal. No. You have to be like, I think the rules are, you have to be totally innocent. Like all your stuff has to look innocent. So if you put nonsense in, then the warden would wonder, like, why does this picture contain nonsense? So what happened to this picture in the first place? Yeah, it looks different from normal pictures apparently. And then he starts to ask those questions into the cells, like, have you guys been playing with the pictures by any chance or so? And then it gets already inconvenient. So that means the rules of the game are, it, like, the warden may not notice anything. Yeah, like it has to look like a natural image, or it has to sound like a natural audio file or so. No? Right. And it's certainly, I mean, it can be discussed. Is it easier if the type of images that we are talking about, if they are noisy already, no? If they are noisier? That's actually a good question. I did not think about that. That probably opens opportunities at least to increase the payload, no? Like to put more information in if there's a higher noise level. I think it might make sense to argue in that direction. Yeah. But that would be a property of the cover. So I think there's maybe a little bit of a confusion also when reading texts about steganography. So it is true that the prisoner may choose the specific cover, like, for example, a picture showing people or a picture showing cars. But the prisoner is not allowed to choose the cover model, like, all my pictures are too dark, yeah, underexposed, no? Because then the warden would say, like, okay, why are they exchanging underexposed pictures all the time? No, it doesn't make sense, no? So, yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.